So this class, and those who you're, I think everyone is here is on the class. The meditation is really teaching us how to observe, how to see clearly, what our experience is like. That in itself has its benefits of letting us learn how to settle ourselves, how to become less reactive and more responsive, and have a greater sense of calmness, of ease in our lives. And from a Buddhist standpoint, the whole perspective, or whole reason to meditate, is to understand what causes suffering. What causes suffering? So I want to speak to that, what's meant by suffering in a Buddhist perspective, to help translate that into our modern experience. Now, the Four Noble Truths are the foundational teachings of the Buddha. And they start with the first one, is that there is suffering, there is dukkha. I think it's helpful to hold that word dukkha as that first noble truth, because suffering, of course, brings up all this cognitions, all these ideas of what that means for us. I'm suffering because of this loss, I'm suffering because of this pain. And that's certainly part of suffering. But dukkha also points to this level of unnecessary suffering, what we add to the moment, how we expand and multiply and really leverage our suffering by adding our resistance to it. Sometimes that resistance takes that mental component that we really spit out into thinking and worry. Sometimes it's the physical manifestation that we're just fighting it. Sometimes it's a subtle quality of just not acknowledging what the moment's holding, as we've been exploring today, and learning to just acknowledge that, to see what's actually here. So dukkha has that quality of the added on unnecessary suffering. And then it actually becomes not a message of despair that there is suffering, but there's actually an unnecessary suffering that's added on to this moment. There's also some subtle aspects of how dukkha happens or manifests itself. Now, dukkha also points to this kind of inherent impermanence of most things, if not all things. There are a few things that maybe one thing that doesn't change. But there's a fact that things are always in flux. You look at who you are, your body is today, and how your body was 10 years ago, and you see the fact of change, the fact that things have not been static. Even the sense of from moment to moment, you may have a sitting of meditation that you feel happy, you feel joyful, and the next time you feel, lost in worry or lost in sleepiness. And there's this pattern of always in flux, always in changing. And so the Buddha would also speak of dukkha in terms of that perspective, that there is this inherent insubstantiality. And he would often point to this, I think very tellingly, toward pleasant states, states which are very meditative states or other states, or experiences which are very pleasurable. And he would say, those are pleasurable, but also know they are dukkha, that they are impermanent. They are subject to change, that are not going to last forever. And often when those things change, when something pleasant leaves us, that's when we experience the suffering around that. So this first noble truth of dukkha, I think it's such an important one to take in, to really acknowledge that. And that's what we've been talking about in the interviews and the questions that have come up and throughout the class, is different ways that we suffer, that we struggle with this moment's experience, the difficulty. Or, it might not just be this moment, it might be some life event that we're dealing with. The change of, not to name different things that came up in the groups, but the different life situations, the different experiences that we have, which can be so trying and so difficult, so challenging. This is all part of being human and how to navigate that. So this first noble truth of learning, okay, there is suffering here, there is difficulty here, becomes this really launching pad into the rest of the practice. And so meditation, you know, we learn how to turn toward that difficulty, how to develop this capacity to meet it. You know, even something as simple as an itch, feeling the impulse to relieve that itch and not moving from it is a way of starting to understand that inherent unsubstantiality and unsatisfactoriness of this moment, and how we have a restlessness of always trying to overcome that. You might just reflect for a moment on how often you've chased happiness in your life. You've tried to avoid suffering and chase happiness. And maybe it was, oh, if I have that particular possession or that particular training or education or relationship or house or car or whatever it might be. Or maybe if I had the absence of these things that are causing so much distress, then finally I'll be happy. But how often does that actually last? How long does that last until that those two change? So meditation, you know, this the art of seeing clearly what's actually present without our distortion, without our judgment, starts to highlight that quality of dukkha in our lives. We start to see it more clearly. The good news is that the Buddha didn't start with just one noble truth. He didn't just say that there is suffering and that's it, just deal with it. He said that the suffering has a cause. That's the second noble truth. The suffering actually originates from something. It's not just random. And this is where we might start to become interested because, okay, there's the suffering I deal with, and if there's a cause of it, maybe there's also a solution to it. Maybe there's actually a way to be free of that. That's the third noble truth. So what is the cause of dukkha, the cause of suffering? We can kind of boil it down to some degree to our relationship to this moment's experience. I think I shared this simple equation at one point in the class that our resistance times experience equals suffering. So imagine a little mathematical formula that whatever experience that you're having, you multiply your resistance to that experience, that creates the level of dukkha, the level of suffering that you experience from that. This is something I learned really early on in my practice within the first few months. And I just really love that because it's like, it doesn't matter what is here in front of me, whatever I'm going through, it's my resistance to it that amplifies the suffering. Say you stub your toe, of course there's pain. But when I get really anxious and upset and angry about that, that's adding another level. And then if I get anxious and angry at the fact that I'm anxious and angry, then I add another level of dukkha around it. So it's really pointing to that relationship to this moment's unfolding, this moment's experience. Now, that shows up often by even the things we've been talking about. You know, from as a teacher, you know, I can see everything I speak about is in the context of this Four Noble Truths. Every time I answer a question, every time I relate to a student, anytime I offer instructions, it's all in respect to these Four Noble Truths. And you can start to see how, if you hear from that standpoint, it's often when someone's struggling or having a challenge, it's pointing out, okay, where that suffering is and noticing how their relationship to it is. And so often, a big part of that is just not allowing the moment to be how it is. You know, I shouldn't be this way. I should be more of that way. And all the myriad ways that we take that and express that. So part of it is really revealed in that simple instruction of whatever is present. Can I simply feel that? Can I simply open to that with steady attention, with kind attention, and without adding anything to it, without adding anything elaboration to it, to this, how this moment is. So this starts to work with those first noble truths of there is dukkha, there is suffering, and then there's the cause of that suffering. Now the cause often, you know, we can get more contracted around that, the more engaged we get, the more charged we get. Another way to say it is the more identified we get with around it, the more we take it personally. You know, I am something's personally at fault. I am personally at fault for this. There's something flawed in me because of this. Or maybe I'm really righteous and upset and proud or, you know, arrogant around this issue. That's also that form of identification. And that's a more subtle way of this second noble truth showing up. One way the Buddha would say that the origin of dukkha is really any type of clinging as I, me, or mine. Any kind of clinging that I, me, and mine. Now, clinging, there's a technical way we can use that. That's really meaning that that way our energy starts to coalesce and form around that. It starts to build momentum. We start to build a sense of agency, a sense of creation around that. Creation of our thoughts, of our identity, of our actions. So going back to that relationship to I, me, and mine, and how we form that, in that sense of this is my emotions, this is my feelings, this is my experience, this is your experience, your actions. Of course, there's a psychological health to owning your experience, that this is my experience. And that's much better than saying, instead of saying, you know, you made me mad, I realize, okay, I'm feeling angry. That's very important to be able to make that shift internally. And again, from a Buddhist standpoint, especially this deeper understanding of this second noble truth, we start to see how that very forming of I creates a sense of separation, the sense of distance between me and experience. And perhaps you've noticed that in the class, that there's times when you've been practicing that distance between you and what you're observing starts to fade, starts to soften. So instead of you observing, there just seems to be the actual observing. And those times, if those have arisen, there's a sense of ease, a sense of peace. It seems like there's nothing that actually needs to be done in this moment. There's a contentment that's there. That's the cooling down, the absence of that clinging, that movement toward. And then the flip side of that is the movement toward. Another way the Buddha described the second noble truth is around tanha, another Pali word often translated as hunger, as thirst, the sense of wanting, the movement toward, or the movement away. And there's part of that hunger is the hunger to be a certain way, to have a certain image, to have people think of me in a certain, you know, perspective, and the way we project that outward. You know, you're a certain kind of person because of the X, Y, and Z. All these are ways that we create that sense of separation, that sense of distance. And so from time to time when you're struggling, just notice those questions. Okay, where am I claiming I? Where am I claiming me or mine? And just hold that as a question. See, okay, maybe that's not the whole story. Maybe there's something that's not just my own narrow identification. Even relating to something like the breath or a sound. See how that sense of you meditating can start to soften. So the breath is just breathing itself. Sound is just being held in this field of awareness. So there's the meditative experience, and then there's the way that our lives really show us where we get identified, where we get stuck. And this is where meditation actually becomes very interesting, to see how life reveals our edges, reveals our stuck spots. So the first two noble truths, the truth of dukkha and the truth of the origination of dukkha, around this thirst, this clinging, this claiming I, me, and mine. And the third noble truth is of the cessation of dukkha, the ending of dukkha. So that, also sometimes called nibbana, the liberation of enlightenment, the release of the heart. Sometimes nibbana is translated as the blowing out, the cooling down, And when it's cooling is those flames of hunger, that flame of identification. You know, so sometimes we hear that, it's like, oh, that means I have to be aloof and distanced from life. It's actually quite the contrary. The life becomes much more immediate and full and rich. It's just free of that contraction of identification, that contraction of reactivity. So the truth of the cessation of dukkha. And this is really the whole point of the practice. Everything, each one of these noble truths is kind of informing each other. And because if we just practice to understand our suffering, understand the cause of it, without ever noticing the cessation of that, and the release of that, the practice would be very heavy, would be very hard. So it's also equally important to notice the times when you aren't clinging, when there's a time of ease in the moment. One teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, was one of my teacher's teacher, talked about everyday nibbana, everyday awakening. And he talked about it in a very ordinary way, that there's actually in each moment, or each day, I should say, there's many moments that we're relating to something without that clinging, without that contraction, without that identification. You might even just take a moment and look around your room and say, see a blanket kind of halfway folded on the couch. If I don't come up to any ideas of what I need to do with that blanket, and I just observe it, that's a cooling of that hunger. There's a way that dukkha is not present. I'm just simply being connected to that experience without anything to do with that experience. And we just usually gloss over those because they don't catch our attention. They're not so exciting. We're really conditioned to notice what's wrong, what needs to be fixed in this moment. But you start to orient to what doesn't have to be fixed. What's perfectly fine, just how it is. And let yourself relax into that. Let yourself soften and surrender into that. You're starting to experience that third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. And this truth can deepen more and more as we gain deeper understandings, as insights arise, we start to change our fundamental perspective in how we view the world. And sometimes there's little openings, sometimes really deep openings, profound openings. Sometimes they last for just a few moments, sometimes forever, sometimes for days or weeks. We start to see that cessation has taken root. And the Buddha was very clear, you know, that I teach two things. I teach dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, the rising of dukkha, the rising of suffering, and the end of that suffering. He was also famously said that I wouldn't ask you to do it if it wasn't possible. And he was very convinced that it is very possible within every human being to understand that release of dukkha. And it's not, I love that it's not about a belief system. It's not about assuming a new religious framework. It's about seeing for yourself the immediacy right here, right now. Now, regardless of whatever spiritual overlay or religious overlay you may place upon your life and that you live from, there's this immediacy of this moment, whether there's suffering or the release of suffering. So these three noble truths, that there is dukkha, there's an origination of that dukkha, a cause of that dukkha, and there's a cessation of that dukkha. And then there's the fourth noble truth, the final truth. Now, the first three are really pointing to this moment-by-moment perspective on how we meet life and how we show up in relationship to that, how we can show up in a way that creates isolation, separation, strife, suffering, or lack of separation, a sense of unity, of interconnection, of peace, of ease, of joy. And these two kind of ways we can relate to the moment. Now, often it feels like what about my life? What about all the things I need to do and fix? What about everything that's ailing the world that needs to be taken care of and addressed? How does that play in? And that's where the fourth noble truth comes in, which is called the path to the end of dukkha, also known as the Eightfold Path. So Eightfold Path is a beautiful way of integrating these two, actually three elements. Integrates our seeing, the practice of meditation, of clear seeing, clear comprehension, of wisdom in that seeing, and compassion in that seeing. That's one element. Another element is the wisdom that grows from that seeing. That through seeing clearly, without our normal distortions, without our normal biases, wisdom naturally starts to reveal itself. You start to see life how it actually is. So there's a sense of wisdom that comes from that. And the third element is that of how we live our lives, how we actually act in the world, how we speak, how we make a living, how do we relate to each other, how do we use our words, our bodies, in a way that's aligned with our wisdom. So the Eightfold Noble Path, you know, the first two folds, and they're all very interconnected, is wise view and wise intention. So wise view is, this is the wisdom aspect, that we see clearly how, what causes suffering and what doesn't cause suffering, as we spoke about, I think, on the talk on thought, I believe. That we can see some thoughts lead to more suffering, some thoughts lead to more ease. So is that perspective, a clear saying. And the intentionality, the wise intention, helps us align our actions with that wisdom. And how we act in the world, the wise action of our bodies, of not causing harm through our sexuality, through stealing, as we talked about last Thursday with the five precepts. How we use our words in a way of wise speech, not only of not lying, but also speaking in a way that's beneficial, that's actually helpful for other people, and noticing the timing of that. And then how we live our lives, our livelihood. And some of us are retired, some of us are still working, some of us work inside the home. All these different expressions of how we make our day-to-day existence. And can that also be really fueled and supported by our deepest wisdom? Can we? Doesn't mean we have to have these profound things we do in our lives through our work. But it is important to see, does my work cause harm? Does it cause harm in a big way? Like if I'm manufacturing weapons or poisons, that's an overt way that harm happens. But there's also the little harms of how we communicate with each other. How do we hold each other? Regardless of whether we're still in our working lives or not, you can see, how do I do my chores? How do I do my household tasks? How do I interact with my neighbors? These are all ways of testing and really, embodying our wisdom that we've learned. And the third section, back to meditation, the concentration, mindfulness are the two links. And this is what we really emphasize a lot in the West, because it seems to be what people land on. If we talked about, come hear about how to, live ethically, you may not have as many people come. But if you learn how to meditate, then suddenly it becomes something that you see for yourself. Like, oh, it actually makes sense, not from an intellectual standpoint, but actually from my own direct experience, that it does make sense to live a kind life, a life based in non-harm. So mindfulness and that steadiness of attention, we've spent these 6 weeks really cultivating and learning. And so this rounds out the Eightfold Path, or also called the Fourth Noble Truth. You can see how the mindfulness lets us develop our wisdom then translates into our actions. As our actions start to become more aligned with our wisdom, we find our minds quieting down. We feel more at ease. And then our meditation becomes quieter and deeper as we start to live our practice. We walk our talk, our minds quiet down, and there's deeper levels of steadiness, more sustained mindfulness that starts to arise. And that allows an even deeper seeing, even deeper wisdom start to arise, a deeper understanding of suffering and the end of that suffering. So just giving that perspective that meditation doesn't have to just be something you do on the side. It's something that you keep in an isolated part of your life. If you do that, that's going to be very beneficial. Just to have a little respite from the busyness of life, tremendously helpful. And the tools of meditation can take us into understanding very deeply the nature of what causes our stress, our deceit, our distress, our difficulty. What causes dukkha? Allows us to see deeply the cause of that dukkha. And then finally, the cessation of that dukkha. And our lives are the place to practice that. In our words, in our body, in our minds. All right, thank you for your kind attention. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle.